From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, thank you so much. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. I know we're far from the first program to suddenly sound different in this time of global health crisis. Louisiana is among the hardest hit of the United States, and thankfully, restrictions have, at last, been put in place that will certainly save many lives. For the first time in our program's history, I am sitting not in a studio, not assisted by able technicians, but alone, and connecting remotely with our producer, Ray Kirstein, in Leipzig, Germany, as well as with our guests across the nation. For so many of us, this new age of social distancing and technical experimentation is an unexpected and unwelcome challenge. But what hasn't changed is the connection among State of Belief listeners, the personnel and the guests, nor has the need for honest, respectful dialogue about some of the most pressing issues at the intersection of religion, government, and politics. And so, with fingers crossed, here we go. Here's what's coming up on this week's State of Belief.
Idaho's governor signing into law two controversial transgender bills. The move makes Idaho the first among states who introduced some 40 such bills this year to enact them.
Idaho's trans girls and women are now banned from being able to play on college or high school women's sports teams. It also means trans people will be unable to try to change the gender marker on their birth certificate. The Idaho Attorney General's office said it could cost $1 million if the state had to defend the birth certificate ban and lost.
At least nobody can accuse Idaho Governor Brad Little of failing to multitask. Even as the nation and his state reel from the deadly COVID-19 pandemic, Little found the time to sign not one, but two pieces of legislation that are widely considered to be the most anti-transgender laws in the country. We'll take a closer look with Harper Jean Tobin, Director of Policy at the National Center for Transgender Equality.
Many churches are now doing online services only.
One local church is asking people to crank up their radios for Sunday drive-in services.
Welcome to Virtual Reality Church.
Communities, including communities of faith, are leveraging today's rich communication technologies to stay connected during a time of social isolation and sheltering in place. For some, streaming worship services are a comfort and an inspiration. Others are finding interactive discussion groups and prayer services to be helpful. Now a new initiative has been added to these resources, and I am eager to hear about the Virtual Pastor Network from organizer Marion Edmonds Allen. But first,
I have to do this to protect the congregation, not from the virus, but from a tyrannical government.
Since our nation's founding, the wall of separation between church and state has offered essential protection for both. Government was not to be subverted in the interests of one religion at the expense of those who do not subscribe to it, nor was the free exercise of religion to be mandated or restricted by government. But in the same way that the constitutionally protected right to free speech nonetheless is abridged by the well-known shouting fire in a crowded theater exception, so too must certain acts be exempt from religious protections. We certainly don't shield cult leaders who inspire criminal behavior and mass suicide from prosecution, even if they act in the name of religion. So what about pastors who insist faith will immunize their flock from the deadly COVID-19 virus? That theoretical question faced a very real-life test in the state of Florida this week as authorities took megachurch pastor Rodney Howard Brown into custody. We are very fortunate to have with us the man who had the weight of that decision on his shoulders, State Attorney for Florida's 13th Judicial Circuit, Andrew H. Warren. Mr. Warren, thank you so much for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure to be here today.
What led to the decision to actually take action in the case of Howard Brown?
Well, Hillsborough County, which is where Tampa is, had passed a local rule promoting social distancing. And it was following best practices by the CDC. And the idea was that we were supposed to limit gatherings to no more than 10 people and to maintain proper 6 feet of distance between. As across the country, we try to flatten the curve and deal with this unprecedented challenge. Locally, we've been pushing for compliance. There's been a lot of conversations between my office with businesses and religious leaders about how they can continue providing the services that they provide while maintaining compliance with the order. This particular pastor and his church stated that they were not willing to adjust what they were doing to be in compliance with the order. They ended up holding a service of 400 to 500 people on Sunday morning where people were standing essentially shoulder to shoulder with each other. The sheriff's office had gone out to speak with them to tell them that they couldn't do that, to discuss how they can make accommodations. In short, just said, look, I'm not going to do anything. I'm not going to do that. When he had made it clear that he was putting his own self-interests above that of not only his parishioners, but everyone else in the community by blatantly violating our social distancing law, we had no other choice but to go ahead and have him arrested to be charged.
Mr. Warren, what was he charged with?
He was charged with two separate crimes. One is for the violation that's passed by our county. And the second was for unlawful assembly, which is basically where you have three or more people who are to violate a law. Both of those charges are in Florida, what are called second-degree misdemeanors. They're essentially the lowest charge under our state law. Each is punishable by a maximum of 60 days in jail, 6 months of probation, and a $500 fine. So these are it's a very low-level offense, especially considering that he may have subjected not only the 400 to 500 people in his church to harm, but thousands that they may have come in contact with afterwards.
Can you recall a similar situation in recent memory, or is this case truly unique?
Dealing with the individual and the facts of the case and the criminal history, this is unique because it's the first time we've had someone who is just so willingly disregard the law in terms of the social distancing mandate that we have in the county and now that our state has in place as well. It's a challenge. You know, it's not a fun decision to make when we know people are going to church in a time of uncertainty and a time of fear where a pastor, and to give him the benefit of the doubt, is trying to provide that spiritual guidance to people. But you can't do it in a way that completely disregards not only the laws that are put in place to protect our community, but frankly, the sacrifices that so many other community members have made. When all the other houses of worship in our community are not doing that, for one person to say, well, it's a, that's an extremely selfish act.
I want to ask you, how is this different from any other cases that you've had? And was the number of potential victims a factor in what was going on?
It is, to the extent that it shows how blatant the violation was. For example, we have a rule in place. Our local ordinance for social distancing is 10 people. If there had been 12 people there and the or any other person had said, well, we're not going to make accommodations, perhaps we wouldn't make the same decision. But when we're talking about 500 people, that's a huge difference. Because again, not only are those people following the pastor's lead, now granted, they're all making their own decision to be there, but pastors have a lot of influence over their parishioners. And where we've had other pastors who have embraced social distancing and advocated people to stay at home and to conduct religious services online and virtually, their congregations have done that. So here we had those congregants, those parishioners who can be viewed as victims, but it's really the risk that they're going to go and spread that, because the argument that, well, these people made the choice themselves to be there really doesn't hold any water if those people aren't continuing to stay in the church for the next month. Once they go back into the community, to our grocery stores and our doctor's offices and our pharmacies, they're now interacting with a lot of other people.
Mr. Warren, what else did you take into account when making this very difficult decision?
Well, we looked at not just what the pastor's actions were, but obviously the nature of the conversation that he had with our sheriff. If people are willing to make adjustments and try to be compliant, and there ends up being some small disagreement about whether they are or not in compliance, it's a separate calculus for us than it is when someone says, I don't really care what you're telling me to do, I'm going to do what I want to do. So we're looking not just at the refusal to be flexible about it, the insistence of subjecting the parishioners to harm, the back into the community and spread COVID-19 to other people, but also, of course, the constitutionality of the law, the penalties under it. And we thought, with everything in place, all the sacrifices that were being made that were on clear constitutional grounds, that two misdemeanor charges were appropriate for someone who was so egregiously violating the social distancing law.
Yeah. Would you talk about how your office has to look at this kind of situation in both a religious context and a secular context?
Well, we don't look at it any differently. It doesn't matter whether they're at a park or at a restaurant or in a house of worship. If they're violating the order, our law enforcement partners are going to ask them to disperse and negotiate how they can what they're doing to come into compliance. But if at the end of the day, if you are refusing a lawful order from law enforcement to stop what you're doing, and you simply refuse to comply, you run the risk of being charged.
Mm-hmm. Has this situation revealed loopholes in public safety legislation that will need to be addressed once this crisis is over?
Hillsborough County's order is more restrictive than some other places around the state. And yesterday, our governor just passed a stay-at-home order that sets a baseline for social distancing. I think just the different orders have led to some confusion. And it's hard because the vast majority of people want to do the right thing. They want to comply with the law. They want to practice social distancing. They want to keep their family safe and their neighborhood safe. When you have different rules coming out, and frankly, the rules changing every few days across the state, you have people who aren't sure whether they're complying with the law. And that's why we are so focused on promoting that compliance. We're not looking to go out and just arrest people as soon as they step over the line here, but that's not what happened in this case. Again, the pastor simply refused to do what he was told by law enforcement. And as the state attorney, Our priority is public safety. And make no mistake, this is about the health and safety of our community.
I'm sure your work is made much more difficult by the of a clear national stay-at-home order. Where else do you find yourself needing to take action to try to help protect Floridians?
Of course, we have voices in our local government who are lobbying, who had been lobbying our governor and continue to lobby our governor for change. But my focus as state attorney is to enforce the laws in a way that is promoting public safety. And so when we have people who are going to follow the laws, that's fantastic. When we're going to explain it to them. And when we have people who are putting their own self-interest above the safety of everyone else in the community, that's when we have to use the hammer of the criminal justice system to coerce compliance.
Would you talk about what these past few weeks have been like and what you are preparing for in terms of the weeks ahead?
These are strange times. I think it's no different here than it is for anywhere across the country, especially in a larger metropolitan area. About 1.5 million people in the city of Tampa's 350,000. So we're dealing with a lot of the same issues where our schools are now closed, where our criminal justice system has had to shut down many of its daily operations and on essential operations that are constitutionally required and those that are necessary to promote public safety. But candidly, there are so many people across our community and country who are struggling both with the health risks of this and with the economic impact. My office, this is really an inconvenience more so than a life-changing event. And we're well aware that we're fortunate that, we're dealing with adjustments to our daily jobs here, but we're healthy and we're going to continue doing what we can for the people of Hillsborough County.
The Honorable Andrew H. Warren is State Attorney for Florida's 13th Judicial Circuit. Thank you so much for valuing our Constitution, and thank you for being interested in the health of our nation, and thank you for taking this time to be with us on State of Belief Radio. It's not an easy thing you're doing, but it is a very good part of our nation being what our nation really is. Please stay healthy as you continue your important work.
Dr. Gaddy, thank you so much.
We're just getting started with this week's show. I'll talk with Harper Jean Tobin from National Center for Transgender Equality about Idaho's shocking new anti-trans laws. And later, an ambitious and inclusive new effort to provide comfort and hope in a time of crisis. You'll hear about the Virtual Pastor Network. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. I'm Welton Gaddy. This past Tuesday was the National Day of Transgender Visibility, a day of support and affirmation for one of the most marginalized and murdered minorities in our country and around the world. On Monday, as allies and admirers prepared their social media posts of support and solidarity, the governor of Idaho was doing something else. He was signing the most damaging and demeaning anti-trans legislation we've seen in this country. For a look at that legislation and what steps will be needed to counter it, I am grateful to connect with Harper Jean Tobin, an attorney and director of policy at the National Center for Transgender Equality in Washington, D.C. Harper Jean, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Hello, glad to be with you.
Would you start, please, by just summarizing these two outrageous pieces of legislation?
Yes, I'm happy to do that. First thing, I do think it's important to recognize how incredible it is that we're even talking about this right now at the moment that we're in, how irresponsible it is to pass and sign legislation focused on stigmatizing and excluding vulnerable youth when we're in the middle of a nearly unprecedented deadly pandemic. You know, how senseless is it to be banning young people from playing sports when schools are shut down, sports seasons are canceled, millions are unemployed, nearly 1,000 people a day are dying in our country, and our leaders should be focused on protecting everyone, not singling people out. So yet here we are, right? Governor Little in Idaho quite appropriately declared an extreme emergency and a statewide stay-at-home order on the 25th of March. And then 5 days later, he signed two new laws just to stigmatize trans youth. Why? So these two bills are HB 500 and HB 509. HB 500 is a completely unprecedented ban on transgender girls playing school sports in Idaho. They are banned in high school, in middle school, in fourth and fifth grade, in every sport. The NAACP has had a policy on trans student athletes playing for a decade. And Idaho colleges are now ordered to ignore the NCAA's policy and ban trans girls from playing every sport. If someone suspects a girl is transgender, schools can demand genital exams or blood testing or genetic testing. Schools are banned from considering any complaints from trans girls or their families about being kicked off teams or out of sports. But schools can be sued under this law if they let a trans girl play. So it's no wonder the NCAA says this law conflicts with their core values of fair treatment of all individuals. And it's no wonder the Women's Sports Foundation and other women's rights groups said in a letter that it would compromise access to sports for many vulnerable youth while doing nothing to support young athletes or address the real threats to girls' sports. At the same time, Governor Little signed HB 509, which bans trans people from correcting their birth certificates to reflect who they truly are. And I think the fact that these two bills were a package really reveals that this is not about anything specific to sports. It's about attacking trans people. You know, Idaho was one of only two or three states that didn't allow trans people to correct their birth certificates. And it was ordered to allow those corrections by a federal court 2 years ago. This bill, this new law, directly defies that court order. The only other state to pass a law similar to this one is Tennessee, which passed it over 40 years ago. Now, when trans people can't update their identification, it forces them to out themselves as transgender and risk discrimination anytime they have to show that document. It's confusing, it's humiliating, it's dangerous. Correcting the document does not change the confidential, historical, and statistical data about your birth. It just lets people live their daily lives in peace, which is why the court said 2 years ago, trans people have a right to these changes. There's no harm to anyone. There's no burden on the state. It's pure cruelty to ban it. And so looking at these two bills, the current and five previous Idaho attorneys general all raised the alarm that these laws are probably unconstitutional, but yet the governor in a moment of extreme emergency and lockdown nevertheless signed them.
Harper Jean, is Idaho uniquely vulnerable to this kind of institutionalized hate mongering, or did the state's transgender population just get incredibly unlucky on this occasion?
Well, this is not specific to Idaho, for sure. This is a coordinated effort led by large, well-funded groups like the Alliance Defending Freedom and other anti-transgender national groups. They are attacking transgender youth on every front. They are in the Supreme Court and in state houses, pushing to make it so you can legally fire or evict someone for being transgender, pushing to ban trans youth from bathrooms and sports clubs, pushing bills to literally lock up doctors for providing care to these youth. That's why we saw new and nearly identical bills all across the country at once this year. Now, the good news is most states have rejected them. Colorado, Florida, Iowa, Kentucky, South Dakota lawmakers said no. This is too extreme, needless, cruel. There are other states that are considering bills like this. particularly sports bans and medical bans in Arizona, Alabama, Louisiana, Missouri, Tennessee. I think with the NCAA coming in against them, they should think twice. But right now, legislatures in most states have closed due to the pandemic, and it's not clear if or when they'll come back. And when they do, I hope they will be focused solely on saving lives from COVID-19 and helping those who are jobless. But the folks pushing these bills in Idaho, you know, they really pushed, even as the state was locking down, to save lives, to squeak these attacks on trans people through.
Do you see the hand of the political religious right in this process?
Well, I think it's important that we recognize there is an organized movement. There is an organized, you know, multi-million dollar anti-trans organization called ADF and many others working on this. And they sometimes say that the reason that they want to stop trans people from having rights and dignity and being part of public life has something to do with religious freedom. Now, all of us value religious freedom. It's in our Constitution for a reason. LGBTQ people, trans people are of all faiths and spiritualities. Most have a religious and spiritual identity. It's certainly a big part of my life. And most people of faith don't want to discriminate. We know that. But when you see ADF representing businesses saying that they have to practice their faith, be able to fire trans people, refuse to serve trans people, that's part of this overall effort to strip trans people's rights away. When they're talking about them trying to ban medical care, trying to ban people from sports teams, ban people from updating their birth certificates, these bills haven't been framed in religious terms. They have been framed with other kinds of fears, baseless fears about transgender people that are belied by the facts. But certainly the idea somehow that there's a war between religious freedom and the very existence of trans people in society is one of the tools, is one of the storylines that we see in this effort to strip trans people of civil rights.
You know, of all the features of Idaho's outrageous new anti-transgender laws, I think the assault on young people is particularly unforgivable. Would you talk about that, please?
Of course. It's really heartbreaking. You know, trans young people, like, you know, young people across the country, are scared right now, are confused. Their schools have been closed. They have to stay home. You know, they're worried about people in their families that might be getting sick. It's the world is scary right now for everyone, right? There's this pandemic. And here, you know, we have leaders also trying to sort of ban and exclude and stigmatize them because of who they are. And, you know, I'm so scared and hurting for trans young people right now who are sort of dealing with both of those things at once. And it's the idea that whenever they are able to go back to school, that they're going to be kicked off of the team, that they're not going to be able to play the sport that they love anymore, whether that's fencing or basketball or whatever it is. And, you know, they're scared that they're not going to be able to see, if they're teenagers, a doctor anymore for medical treatment in the bills that some of these states have proposed. Fortunately, neither Idaho nor any other state has passed those bills to criminalize medical care yet, but it's part of the same effort. So I think that the folks pushing these bills, they're capitalizing on the instinct that we all have that we want to protect young people. But they say that banning trans people, that these other kids need to be protected from trans kids. And I think what we're hearing from athletes of all ages, from sports organizations, from women's rights groups, is that's nonsense. You know, the real threat to girls' sports, other than getting COVID-19, is schools not doing enough to stop the harassment and the abuse of athletes, is the fact that, you know, there's not opportunities for, you know, women working as coaches, or the fact that girls' sports still don't get enough resources and practice space and opportunities. Those are the real issues. And the same thing with when it comes to trying to ban medical care. You know, it's the idea that somehow affirming and supporting trans people and following the medical standards of care, somehow these young people are going to get are actually going to get hurt by helping them. And so we have to ban helping them. And it takes advantage of the fact that there's not a lot of understanding of trans youth, of the really sort of the medical consensus on them, the standards of care, the sort of gradual, careful, individualized, step-by-step model of care for trans teens. And so these bills are being passed on some gut level because of people think and say that they're trying to protect young people, but it's being used for this agenda that's actually just going to hurt them.
Harper Jean, what concrete steps can people of goodwill in Idaho take right now, to help counter the damage this legislation will do?
Well, if there's anything this pandemic has taught us, it's that we are all in this together, is that nobody is safe and protected and kind of able to live life and have a good future unless we all are, right? Everything that we see now in a magnified way, how everything that we do impacts each other. And of course, the most important thing every person should be doing in Idaho and around the country is helping to fight this pandemic, staying home as much as humanly possible, listening to public health guidelines. If you can, donating to emergency funds to help people, whether they're trans, and a lot of them are or not, who are out of work or hurting right now. But I think it's also important that we call out our leaders, that we call and write our governors and say, we demand that you be working to stop this pandemic right now, to get masks to hospitals, to help people who are jobless, to make sure the accurate information is out there, to help move people out of crowded jails and shelters where the virus is spreading, and not to be attacking trans youth and doing these other counterproductive distractions. And I think that even though Governor Little has signed the bill, he still needs to continue to hear from voters in his state, and governors and lawmakers in other states, they need to hear from people. Members of Congress need to hear from people. We need you to be doing absolutely everything you can to save lives from the pandemic right now, and nothing else, and certainly not attacking trans youth, because it's unacceptable.
I'm sure you're familiar with Project Blitz, the far-reaching political religious right effort to draft extreme legislation and distribute it to compliant state lawmakers across the country. Do you know if these Idaho bills came from this kind of law mill, and if so, are we likely to see similar proposals in other states as well?
Yes, this is coordinated. It's not always clear exactly which groups are promoting which bills in which states, but, you know, South Dakota was one of the first states to advance these sports and medical bans, one of the lead legislators on them said, I went to a conference at the Heritage Foundation in D.C., and there were a bunch of lawmakers there from a bunch of states, and there was a discussion about how we should pass this bill, and I came back and decided I'm going to introduce that in my state. And that's what we saw all around the country. We'd never seen some of these bills introduced before, to ban young people from playing sports, to make it a crime to provide medical care to teenagers. And yet we saw nearly identical bills all over the country at once. I think that in some ways, the more important thing than the fact that it's coordinated is the fact that it's not coming from medical experts, from sports leaders. It's coming from with an agenda that trans people should not be part of society.
Would you talk about what the National Center for Transgender Equality is doing to oppose this kind of destructive legislation?
NCTE works on public policy and public education. We're part of a rich community of state, local, and national organizations fighting for trans people's lives in the legislatures, in the courts, in schools, in the streets, in every part of American life. And there are, whether it's local grassroots organizations serving trans people and local community centers, or, you know, national organizations like ours that focus on public policy, we're working together. Our specialty happens to be on public policy. So NCTE has worked to support organizers across the country on good and bad bills and regulations and policies. And right now we see we need a whole movement working together We know there are legal organizations, Lambda Legal, ACLU, who are going to be suing Idaho officials over these new laws. We know that there are LGBT clinics and community centers and grassroots groups all around the country trying to help folks out during this pandemic. There's groups like the Trevor Project and the Trans Lifeline and others who are trying to provide support, mental health support and crisis support for people right now. And so we have a lot of folks working together to support trans folks and really fight for our lives and our ability to be part of society.
How can our listeners get involved to support your work and to help prevent this kind of hateful lawmaking in the places where they live and where they vote?
The number one most important thing every person in the country should be doing right now is helping fight the pandemic by staying home as much as humanly possible, washing your hands, and following public health guidance. We've all got to get through this together. But the other thing that you can do is make sure you're registered to vote. Find out how to sign up to vote by mail in your jurisdiction for the primary, if you still have one coming up, for the general election in the fall, because we don't know what's going to happen with a lot of these state legislatures. But if you could possibly sign up to vote by mail, do it, because one of the most important things we can do to be heard is vote, and it is an election year. People should also be writing to their members of Congress and demanding another relief bill, and one that actually reaches people, reaches everybody, regardless of their immigration status or where they live or what kind of work they do, because that's going to make sure that more folks, including trans folks, get through this crisis. Write to your lawmakers, write to your governor, tell them, we need you to focus on doing absolutely everything you can as quickly as humanly possible to save lives, to help the jobless, to get people through this crisis and nothing else, and stop the attacks on trans people.
Harper Jean Tobin is Director of Policy at the National Center for Transgender Equality. You can learn more about the center's important work at www.transequality.org. Harper Jean, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much. Take care. Wash your hands. Protect yourself. Protect everybody else.
As the global health crisis unfolds, almost no part of our lives is left untouched. That certainly extends to religion and spirituality. And while mass worship gatherings are a terrible idea right now, online resources offer unprecedented options for connection and reassurance. An ambitious example is the newly launched Virtual Pastor Network from the Online Faith Collective. And I am delighted to be joined by the Reverend Marion Edmonds Allen, Executive Director of Parity, which is sponsoring the network. Marion, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Dr. Gaddy, thank you. It is my pleasure.
You're a longtime State of Belief listener. What's interesting is we've been reaching you through technology for years, so it's appropriate that we're now talking about the technology-based outreach you've established in a time of crisis. It comes full circle, doesn't it?
It truly does. And yes, I have been a faithful listener for years and a big fan, to be honest.
Well, that's good. We have that on tape. Listen, describe for us the Virtual Pastor Network and what made you think this could be helpful, if you would.
Absolutely. The idea came from seeing my pastor colleagues online on Facebook and being aware of their beautiful ministries in the world, and also seeing the individuals on Facebook who were desperately in need of a pastor but didn't know any. So I was thinking about those two worlds and thinking, well, how can I bring them together? So I did one Facebook post asking for volunteer pastors, and I've been flooded. There have been dozens and dozens of people reaching out, really wanting to help. When I posted asking for volunteers, within 5 minutes, I had 10. And it's just grown and grown. People all over the country and people all over the world from over 20 different denominations and faith systems.
I want you to talk more about that, because the diversity of backgrounds is so very helpful. Describe the range of traditions and the geographical regions. I'm just really interested in that.
I was very surprised at that, actually, Dr. Gaddy. The first volunteer we had was a Catholic individual from a red state in the United States. And then it went from very progressive religions, Christian, Buddhist, to very conserving religions like Pentecostal, evangelical, a range of ages from people newly ordained to folks who had been retired for years. And so many who are chaplains, who are had been first responders and then became chaplains later in their career, a wide variety of people from all over.
Do you interview people before they become connected with what you're doing so that they can be a part of the network? How do you handle that?
We have is an online form where we ask people to talk about their background and their experiences, their credentials. And then from there, I do follow up and ask them more questions if need be. And it's been really amazing to me, the folks who will say, well, I've been a 30-year head chaplain in this hospital network, or I've been a senior pastor for so many years in my Baptist congregation, humbled. I can't wait to be a part of this. They're just so excited to be a part of it, which I'll say I've been moved to tears so many times by hearing their stories and about why they want to help.
I'd like for you to share one or two experiences that come to your mind of what happens on the network.
Absolutely. One interaction that really touched me right away was again from Facebook, was a woman who posted underneath, and she wasn't clergy, but what she said was, I need a pastor. So I immediately messaged her to find out more. And then I was so grateful that I had all of these wonderful new volunteers to match her with. And it's been that way, that there have been folks who have very particular needs, say around grief, and mm-hmm. then I can match them with a pastor who has 30 years of hospice experience, for example.
Hmm. Do you have people come for counseling, for conversation, who don't have a religious background?
Absolutely. And I think that's the beauty of it. And that's what we're trying to lean into, is that it doesn't need to be someone who is, oh, I'm a staunch, whatever religion. It can be anyone with spiritual questions or someone who just wants a compassionate ear. We do not discriminate. Any and all faiths and no faiths is what we say.
Mm-hmm. A lot of faith leaders listen to State of Belief, so tell them how to get involved if they feel called to do so.
Thank you for that opportunity. On our website, onlinefaithcollective.org is a link, and we are also launching a new website today called virtualpastors.org. So that's the place where you can go. You can fill out a form. You can also get in touch with me. I'm so glad to answer any questions.
This was launched under the auspices of the Online Faith Collective. Talk about that initiative, please.
We started that about 2.5 weeks ago. And the idea there, it was just when social distancing was starting and pastors were needing to cancel their in-person worship services. So I thought, okay, I'm seeing these good folks move to online worship. Wouldn't this be a terrific opportunity for people at home to find a worship service that they could be part of, that they could live stream? So I started collecting submissions, and now there are dozens and dozens of all faiths and more every day. The website is onlinefaithcollective.org, and we have many different faiths and denominations, different religions, folks who are spiritual but not religious, a wide variety. So someone could go to the website, look through the listings, and find something that looked appealing. There's live stream, and then there's recorded services as well.
And anybody can come to you as they wish, whether they are wanting to be a part of the ministry or whether they want to get the ministry that you offer.
Absolutely. Any person. We say, and we are LGBT affirming, that's Parity's mission in the world. And that also means that we don't discriminate in terms of folks for whom LGBT isn't a part of their traditional faith system. We welcome any and all people. We affirm everyone on their journey. Parity is an organization that works at the intersection of LGBT and faith. We promote both, and we also do a lot of bridging work in the world. And Dr. Gaddy, I'll say you're a large inspiration for that. So what we try to do is between people of different perspectives and to have faith at the centerpiece of all of that for all people.
I love that an LGBTQIA-focused ministry is able to take the lead in bringing together people of faith and faith leaders from around the world and across the denominational spectrum in a moment of crisis. We've come a long way. And even in a moment of such crisis, it is essential to appreciate the blessings that are present among us in such abundance. What's happened and what's going on in our nation right now? Have you seen an influx of people interested in what you're doing? And what are people saying to the people who counsel for you?
What we've been noticing and what I've been seeing in the world in news reports is there's a huge increase in faith and a huge increase in people who want to be part of worship services. So that's a big part of it. The other part that I've seen is, like you just said, Dr. Gaddy, people are really coming together. The things that we've seen as such insurmountable differences between us aren't as important now, and we're seeing that we want to help care for each other and care about each other. And people are stepping up to volunteer, and people who need help are reaching out as well. It's a blessing to be able to connect the two.
The Reverend Marion Edmonds Allen is Executive Director of Parity in New York City, the sponsor organization of the Online Faith Collective and the Virtual Pastor Network. Marion, what a great gift to hear from you today. Thank you for what you're doing. Thank you for being with us. And let's talk again.
That would be a pleasure. Thank you, Dr. Gaddy.
That's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, let me say a very sincere thank you. Your generous support of this program is vital to keeping us on the air. If you think there's value in what you've heard here, and you think it's important that others hear it as well, please make your contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. And do you know someone who you think might benefit from hearing what you're hearing? Please commit to sharing State of Belief with just one person this week.
as more and more of us try to do our part to reduce the relentless spread of this deadly pandemic by staying home, it's my hope that your friends and family members will find what we do both interesting and helpful, and that you do as well. With as many governments and health experts around the world requiring citizens to stay at home to protect themselves and others, please don't wait for your jurisdiction to mandate that. Please utilize every means available to minimize your risk. As the heartbreaking list of famous names succumbing to COVID-19 keeps growing, each human life represented by the thousands of deaths that have already happened was precious, and this loss will forever impact many others forever. I promise that we'll do our best to continue this broadcast safely. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform, and take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and be part of the conversation. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And an important reminder, Alliance President Rabbi Jack Moline continues to conduct timely and interesting conversations with leaders and activists from across the multi-faith spectrum. The Facebook Live series is titled Stay Home, Stay Focused, and it airs weekdays at 12:15 Eastern Time at facebook.com/interfaithalliance. If you follow the Alliance on Facebook, you can get reminder notifications when the live stream begins, Monday through Friday. And be sure to join us right here next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Never have my regular closing words to you been more important. Until we get together again, you all take care of each other. And those words include you, each of you. You take care of yourself, and all of you take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.